This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Artist Maya Freelon's technique elevates tissue paper from a common craft material to fine art. Her elaborate tissue paper sculptures have hung in the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Smithsonian Arts and Industries Building. She's received commissions from Google and Cadillac and was recently named one of the 5 young artists to watch during the Miami Art Week. An artist's talent runs in her family. Her mother is acclaimed jazz artist Nina Freelon. Her father, Phil Freelon, was a renowned architect. And her paternal great-great-grandfather, or great-grandfather, I should say, Alan Freelon, was a pioneering Impressionist-style painter during the Harlem Renaissance. And while she draws inspiration from the artists in her family, she is also deeply shaped by her ancestors who worked the land as sharecroppers. Artist Maya Freelon is with me in the studio today. Maya, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Let's talk a little bit about this being one of the artists to watch. You were at the Prism Art Fair in Miami. Tell us about that and kind of what that scene is.
I, along with 4 other artists from the RDU area, were selected by Prism, which is an art fair that runs concurrently with Art Basel Week, which is the first week in December each year. This is a fair that focuses mainly on African and African-American artists and artists from the African diaspora. So it was a beautifully run fair that just showcased some art that sometimes is missed in these major markets. And it's the biggest international art fair in North America. So I was glad to be there to represent Durham, but also other Black female artists.
You know, I've talked and I've seen you talk about this question of whether you want to be identified as a female artist, a Black female artist. And I think you've had some really interesting thoughts on that.
I did. I actually claim it all. And I feel like visibility is important. I saw as a young person, a mentor of mine, Beverly McKeever, an artist working in Durham, working at Duke. I asked her, was this your full-time job? And she said, yes. I sat and I went to Durham School of the Arts at the time. I cleaned her paintbrushes. I watched her sell art. I went to her openings. And I said, if she can do that, I can do this. And I haven't looked back ever since. I really enjoy being an artist that's visible. And I always say, like, if you're an artist who doesn't want to claim that, I will take that grant. I will sign up for that mentorship because there is a disparity. And I believe that we do need a chance to shine. And right now, Black artists, female and queer, are embracing and enjoying their identities as varied as they are. I think identity is very personal and important. And to me, I embrace that.
Well, I just, whenever I hear that question or I hear somebody sort of walk away from it and say, well, I'm an artist first, I think, well, there is no art apart from your identity. If you don't have an identity and I don't have one, and much of it is shaped by the cultural forces that over which we had no choice. I mean, I understand that these things are, in a sense, cultural fictions, but man, they do shape us. And therefore, the art would be meaningless if we didn't somehow connect to those.
Yeah, exactly. At the same time, you mentioned my great-grandfather, Alan Freelon, who was my dad's grandfather. He was an Impressionist painter, so you wouldn't maybe know by walking up to his paintings that was a Black man creating art at the turn of the century. He also got his master's in art at Temple University, which was Tyler School of the Art. It was eventually called that. He was criticized by his peers. The New Negro Movement pressured Black artists to make art that was only depicting images of Africa and our history. And I, as an abstract artist, have also run into, you know, why don't you make this? Why don't you make that? You make what you make and you identify how you identify. My great-grandfather was also a photographer, and a lot of his subjects were Black people and people around him and his community and family. So it's not an either-or situation. You can do both.
And you mentioned Beverly McKeever, who inspired you, also a Black female artist, and that was part of what you saw in who she was, right?
That was part of what I saw. I saw myself in her. And that's why I think it's important to always mention, without fixating on it, you can still appreciate it. And that was tremendous for me. It changed my whole perspective in life. Even coming from two artistic parents, I did not see a fine artist in that way, a Black female. So I think that I do highlight it and put it on the forefront of what I do.
Talk about your work with tissue paper and the way that you work with it, and the way water also plays a part in this.
So tissue paper as a medium is actually a beautiful story. I found the tissue paper in my grandmother's basement. And when I went to graduate school, again, the only Black female in my program, no Black faculty in the graduate school.
So where'd you go?
I went to the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which is associated with Tufts now. And it was, I went straight out from Lafayette College, straight into graduate school, kind of running, hitting the ground running. They told me that an artist, Mary Magdalene Campos Pons, was going to be the professor there. They had her in the brochure. I was so excited to work with her. I called her, got her contact information. She said, oh, they don't pay me enough to work there, and they should take my photo off of the pamphlet. And I felt kind of bamboozled and tricked and lost. And thankfully, I lived with my grandmother at the time, and she was the type of grandma that never threw anything away. Her basement was filled with stuff from Confederate money to old Jet magazines to T-shirts and photos with James Baldwin and Maya Angelou. She had a connection with all the folks from that would come and speak at Harvard, and she was not a shy woman. Queen Mother Frances Pierce would walk right up to you and tell you you were a beautiful blessing, and get your phone number and write down your address and keep in touch. And so her bright personality inspired me, but she also had a collection of archives from her many years, and she didn't throw it away. So if you imagine a grandma's basement filled from floor to ceiling with things, it was a found artist's dream. So I'm in there looking for something for my next project. I was mainly a sculptor and a painter, but I also loved mixed media. And I look under a stack of papers. I see kind of a rainbow, a bright array of paper. And I pull it out, and it's a rainbow sheet of paper, tissue paper that was stacked. But there's a beautiful stain on it. And I thought, how did she get this stain on this paper? I know she was a school teacher. She was also a hairdresser. Of course, as soon as I pulled it out, which she probably hadn't seen for at least 50 years, she goes, oh, I was saving that for you, honey. And I said, oh, well, thank you. I took it to my studio, and I tried to gently pour water with my artist-taught self with a gentle brush, watercolor brush. I was getting nothing until I I dripped water from a height. And what I realized is that the paper had a water leak. It was water damaged. Right. It made this universal circle, this line, this water was once here. And it reminded me of looking up at E.K. Poe Elementary School in Durham, North Carolina, on this drop tile ceilings that had the little brown stain. Or you walk past a construction site and you see the paper with the watermark. It's a sign that water was once here. It's a universal sign that you see during flooding and any kind of even your bathtub drain, you sometimes see that mark. And I thought about this being universal. At the same time, Hurricane Katrina was bearing down on the Gulf Coast, the same month that I started working with tissue paper. And I thought about water literally moving color to the outskirts and kind of flushing things. So theoretically and inspirationally, I embraced this medium that was considered craft or tissue, decoration or something that you could put in the bag. And I thought, perfect for grad school. I brought it in, and I was told by my white male professor that it was too beautiful. It looked like hotel art. I would never go anywhere with it. And I was discouraged at my first critique showing this paper. And then I decided to apply to a residency, a prestigious residency called Skowhegan, and I only submitted tissue paper. And I said, well, if they don't get it, then I'll go back to what I was doing before. And I was accepted in 2008, attended, I took only tissue paper and made art with this medium for 3 months, discovering, getting it wet, ripping it up, pushing it to the edge. And that's when I have not gotten tired of it. It's been 15 years of this paper.
Well, let's go off on a little tangent based on what you just said. Those two observations, one you'll never get anywhere, the other you're accepted, let's move forward. What, obviously, these things are subjective to some degree. What do you think is the difference? What's happening in those two subjectivities where one can actually see what you intended, perhaps what you intended, or at least see something more meaningful?
I think that a woman named Linda Early was one of the directors at the time, and she saw the struggle of the medium and introduced, she believed in me, and I needed someone to believe in me. My grandmother, of course, but doesn't everybody's grandma believe in them? I had that, but I was still unsure and unsteady. I was taught that art is this and not that. I was taught the hierarchy of art. I actually had to unlearn a lot of what I was taught in school. I had to teach myself the black artists. I had to visit with Emma Amos at Skowhegan and have her encourage me. I also was discouraged by other folks there because they didn't understand it. But as soon as I attributed my own value and my own worth, then I didn't run into those issues anymore. And the fact that the material was fragile and transient and ephemeral and super colorful in a very kind of palette that I couldn't really change that, I started thinking, well, how do I make sculptures out of it? How do I use the ink that drips and turn that into a painting? How do I make an object that that makes more sense, kind of pulling it all together? Yeah. So I made up different techniques.
When did you first get interested in art?
I think I always loved art. I mentioned my elementary school. I won a contest. I remember like a coloring contest in second grade, not because I was coloring inside the lines, by the way.
Okay, good.
It looked, I don't know why they chose me. It could have been random, but that I always attribute as my very first recognition, Car Drugstore on 9th Street. Okay. But I've always
was
loved
it. Was it hanging up then?
It was hanging up. It had the ribbon and everything. but it's just, Durham is such an amazing place for artists. I don't think I realized that after going around to school, and that everybody didn't have an arts council and everybody didn't have art grants and everybody didn't support, you know, something arts in the schools and education. Yeah. So
you did that. And as you say, you studied it. You luckily had a grandmother who saved for you your medium for perhaps 50 years until you arrived. But there it was somewhere. And so this has been your life. You're now enjoying great success. But a lot of that success has been not without a lot of personal pain.
Yeah.
You suffered the loss of a newborn child. Tell me about Wonderful.
So Wonderful popped in and popped out so quickly, but left such a mighty impact. A lot of times we get scared to talk about infant mortality in general, but Wonderful had an illness called anencephaly, which meant that he wouldn't survive outside of the womb. I only found out in my 30th week of pregnancy because I was having a midwife. Like I mentioned before, I had a home birth, uncomplicated, fine pregnancy before, and I was expecting the same. My midwife, Nancy Harmon, said, you need to go ahead and get one ultrasound. I got it, and I immediately knew something was wrong. I had a meeting at UNC. They said his cranium did not finish forming when he was, I think that happens at like 4 weeks gestation, and a lot of people go ahead and terminate pregnancy since the viability is not possible outside of the womb. Luckily, I did not have to make that choice. I was already far along, and I just had to plan his life and his birth and his death at the same time. So that was a significant impact in my life and career.
Talk about that. I mean, you say luckily you didn't have to make that choice.
I just feel blessed that I would, because it when the child is so small, or the fetus or embryo, whatever you want to call it, it's easy to kind of say, you know, let's just start again. I, for whatever reason, did not get to have that choice, because I was assuming that everything was fine. Thankfully, I had already bonded and loved and appreciated and learned that he loved Pizza Hut and Funfetti cupcakes. And so I didn't have to. We had a bond. Those are things I don't eat normally, by the way. So those cravings, he kicked, he moved just like a child that wasn't ill. So I got to know him. And if I hadn't gotten to know him, I wouldn't have been able to attribute his life to really finally understanding my art and why my art made out of tissue paper and the beauty of now and appreciating these little moments in life, whether they're 5 minutes, 2 days, 3 days, or a million years, you know, we appreciate those moments. You just you can't take anything for granted. And he showed me how to not fear death and how to appreciate the beauty of now, even in a terrible situation.
Had you been working with tissue paper by then?
Or was yes.
It, yeah.
I had already written my artist statement and talked about things for the fragility of life and nature. It only finally made sense to see my child born and die shortly after, to understand why my art had purpose beyond just the beautiful kind of nature of it.
So you talk about the power of this experience in your life, but it did leave you with depression that was pretty difficult.
It was devastating to say goodbye. It stopped everything. I just froze in my tracks. I didn't know what to make. I didn't know if I could make art anymore. It was the beginning of the end of a marriage that was 10 years. It was a stopping point for me. Before that, I can't even think of any trauma I had. I had a great childhood, great parents, didn't witness anybody pass except for my grandparents. And they were elderly. So it was shocking. It's not something that you think about, but it's also something that's not talked about that often. So I felt like it was my duty to celebrate his life and to let people know that infant mortality, miscarriage, all of those things are important to discuss, and your mental health should be at the top priority, just as much as anything else that you do.
But for a while, you weren't even able to work, right?
I wasn't. I felt frozen. I felt stuck. I felt like, luckily, I had a gallery in D.C., Morton Fine Art, that helped sell the work that I'd already made, so I wasn't completely income-less. But I was living basically alone with another small child, grieving and unsure of my next steps.
When were you able to work again, and how did that happen?
So I basically stopped everything. I just made sure that my son made it to his little preschool, which was only half a day, and picked him up from that. I traveled back and forth. I lived in Chapel Hill at the time, and my ex-husband would come on the weekends and check on us. But for the main part,
from Baltimore?
Yes, from Baltimore. He lived in both places. And I just sat and waited. I didn't know what to do, so I knew that I wanted to have another child eventually. But I wasn't even able to make art, so I didn't know where that was going to come from. And then a miracle happened. I got pregnant again, and I was overjoyed but also scared. But there was like a little glimmer of hope in there, and I was able to get ready to anticipate things again. I knew that my child would be born. I prayed that my child would be born. I was actually quite fearful of the actual birth process, and once she was delivered, it was like my light came back and I was able to breathe again and work again. And amazingly, because of the work that Amy did in D.C., Cadillac called me and was like, are you down for a big tissue paper installation? It was almost like the spark that I needed. Wow. And I was like, well, I'm pregnant. And they're like, okay, how about 6 weeks after your due date? And I was like, okay, let me say yes and figure it out from there.
Have you ever thought about what would have happened if that call had come 6 months earlier?
I am so glad that it didn't.
I just wonder.
But the call was like a call to action. It was like, this is what you were put on earth for. You had a break. it's time to start working again. And I had an amazing support system. At the same time, you know, the birth of the child also signified a giant impact in my life and a separation from my ex-husband. And that was also a shock to me.
Well, talk more about that, because again, this is this highlight. You're back. The lights are on, as you say, and the call comes, and then this shocking news.
Yeah, I actually said to him, "Hey, I finally feel like I can breathe again. I feel the sun. I can taste food again. I'm ready to work. I got this Cadillac gig. Like, this is, I'm finally feeling like I have a grip on things." And he said, "Okay, well, I'm glad that you told me that. All of your dreams, all of your intuition, everything that you had asked me about was true. I was in a relationship with someone else. I have twin girls that were born 10 days after Nova was born. And, you know, that's the reality. I'm sorry I couldn't tell you earlier." Well, I'm glad he didn't tell me earlier. That would have been terrible. But it was the same feeling that I had when they told me Wonderful, which was the baby that passed away. Yeah. When they told me he had anencephaly and he will not live past birth, I felt the exact same way when MK told me that he had had twin girls with somebody else, which meant that I was pregnant alongside someone else. It was such a clear decision. Either you crumble into a million pieces and die, or you say, "Okay, I got that information. Thank you so much. Now I'm ready to move on. I will celebrate his life. I will have a life after this. This does not define me." And it just, it was, I went from Chapel Hill right to my parents' condo downtown. They're like, "Okay, what's going on, Maya? Are you good?" And I'm like, "You know what? I'm going to be. Here's your newborn grandchild. And let me get my bearings here. Let me go back to what I know. Let me get Ion straight. Let me make sure that the family is okay." But again, my dad gets diagnosed with ALS that same year. And so we're having another family crisis that needs to be dealt with. So my issue took a step down, and then my dad's jumped up. And again, we had to either embrace it or fall apart. And in my family, we all took three steps closer. And so that moment allowed us to even, the fact that I'm here and decided that, you know, I'm done with men. I'm queer and gay and all that. So my dad's like, "Okay, cool. Like, what's for dinner? Because I'm hungry," you know, not a problem at all. We just hit the road running, and the new plan was figure it out as we go.
Because you had a son already who is, that's Ion, right?
Ion, yep. He's five. He was five at the time.
He was five at the time. The newborn, Nova, your dad, Phil Freelon, who passed recently, who had been, you're talking about the diagnosis of ALS, and all of you are coming together now in this home. And as you say, the marriage has dissolved. You mentioned something a minute ago about dreams and intuitions. So this was part of it. You sort of knew this was coming?
I just knew that I probably knew when Wonderful died that our relationship was ending, and I probably could have listened to my intuition a little bit sooner. But I was able to affirm that before anybody says anything, you need to look at actions and to always trust your intuition. Mm-hmm. Your intuition is never going to steer you wrong. So I think I was kind of obsessed more with what the words that were being said to me as opposed to what I was feeling from my heart. And I'm the type of person that believes that everything happens for a reason and there are no mistakes. So when I receive tragedy or sadness or news that is discouraging, I always look for the silver lining behind it. And I did the same that as well. And that allowed the death of Wonderful and the death of my marriage also allowed for us to embrace ALS in a very different way than most people do.
And this is the period where one of the other good things to come out of this, when you met Jess, right?
Yeah, I have an amazingly supportive partner who really showed me what a friend is. Jess has her own nanny agency, but at the time I met her was at this preschool where Ion went to school. And we had an amazing connection just off the fact that I saw the way she worked with kids. And I asked her, would you be my nanny? And she said, actually, I'm here with a whole nother family, which showed her integrity, but also made me really appreciate the fact that she was loyal. And I said, well, how long is the wait? She said 2 years. I said, no problem. You know, I don't know what's going to happen between here and there, but I definitely want you to be my nanny. And she was like, that's fine. No problem. And as I was waiting and learning, and then at the time, I didn't know all of the stuff was about to happen. Wonderful had just passed when I met her. And then as soon as I was getting ready for the Cadillac shoot, you know, I was asking her, I was in a situations and trying to date with a newborn. It was just a whole mess. And my parents, again, were just looking at me like, oh, Maya, you know, she'll get it together one of these days. And Jess, her sweet self, just kind of saw what was happening and offered support and love in a time where I was super vulnerable. And she really is a light and joy of my life and the example of a really great partner, someone who's in partnership with you.
And what's happening to your art at this time?
So right now, when I do an installation or, for example, at the Art Box, you can see an installation right on Six Forks Road. You can drive by anytime. It's lit and available to the public. I also have some workshops coming up where I'm actually going to make tissue quilts with people.
But I'm wondering, too, at that moment, you know, you talked about the fact that you were already working in tissue when Wonderful passed, and so now suddenly the relevance of this and the importance of working with this fragile and beautiful material becomes even more, you know, exquisite in a way. Were there any other insights, and did your work change in this moment?
So what happened is my work opened up to some new collaborations, new meanings. And for the first time, I invited somebody in to help work with me. And that was Jess. I had never worked with a partner before. And the work created, when I worked with somebody who has a background of a farming community and the land, that really transformed the idea of, my grandmother said, we came from a family of sharecroppers that never got their fair share. And that idea of a handmade life and making a way out of no way, these are mantras that have been ingrained in me for a while. My grandmother would always say, I'm planting seeds that will reap great dividends. And
your grandmother, she would show you her hands,
she
would, too, right?
She showed me her hands. She said, we worked the fields. We made a way for you to stand on. You stand on our shoulders. And I, as I witnessed some of the upbringing that Jess had, it made my art feel that much more rich. And I think as an artist, you do have to develop and grow. You can't just stay where you were 10 years ago. You take your life experiences and pour that into your art too. So for the first time, I felt like I was producing fruit and thinking about the quilt making, like the quilts of G's Bend. Now that a curator comes and puts it on the wall in a museum, it's art, but they were artists their whole lives. I come from that line of that lineage, that creative artisan that my great aunt taught me how to make a quilt. So I implemented those into the tissue quilts that are flying in the Cadillac commercial. It's just amazing for them to witness and see and be alive to see how something so simple and so delicate can transform into a three-story monumental sculpture.
Tell us more about this connection to the land, especially because of Jess's family and how what you learned about that connection and how it affected your art.
Sure. So the exhibition that I have coming up at Cam Raleigh in July will be a collaboration between the land and the and the tissue paper. So I have a photograph of a old tractor lifting up some tissue paper that was actually captured by a local photographer, Chris Charles. And Jess is actually the one who drove the tractor. She's got land, her family, the Van Hooks, have land in Hurdle Mills, Hillsboro, and Cedar Grove. And it's been in the family for a long time. And I thought about the idea of power and wealth when the rest of the city is getting gentrified. They have held on to the land because what happens when the developers swoop in is the taxes get reassessed and it pushes people out who have owned their land for generations. And then they cannot afford the property taxes on it. So I thought about, again, attributing my own wealth, building my own infrastructure, developing my own design, keeping ownership of my creative and intellectual property, and how that happens within a historical land preservation perspective. And so putting those together, it made perfect sense with my art.
Talking to artist Maya Freelon today, an artist now living in Durham. She grew up here, as a matter of fact, spent some time away. Now she came back. Her family is a familiar name, of course, around this part, these parts of North Carolina. Her mother, an acclaimed jazz artist, Nina Freelon. Father Phil Freelon was an architect celebrated for his work on the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Her brother, Pierce Freelon, a frequent guest on this program, hip-hop artist, and now a politician currently running for state senate. But her most recent artistic influence comes from her partner Jess's side of the family and the land. We were just talking about that. And you were featured in a new book from the editors of Garden and Gun magazine called Southern Women. And you chose to do the photo shoot at the farm. Tell us about that.
So, like I mentioned before, the farm and that land is just such a charged up place. And when I first visited, I just felt immediately at home. And there's a lake outside, if you see the picture, standing in front of water. And that lake is one of the last kind of family gatherings that we had where my dad was mobile enough to go fishing, which is one of the things that he just loved to do. So this place where this family just opened up their space and home to our family, it was just a beautiful moment. So when Garden and Gun called me and they're like, oh, do you want to do, we would love to feature you in this book of Southern Women. And I was thinking, gardens, guns, I'm not a good gardener. And I just took me to the gun range like twice. And I don't think I'm good at those either. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, I don't think you have the right lady. And she, Amanda Heckard, the editor, goes, actually, we're highlighting women who thrive in the South or despite of the South. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that, about the reasons why I chose to come back home, why I chose to raise children here. Something about North Carolina, specifically Durham, feels like home. It feels safe. It feels welcome. It feels supportive. And that's how I felt when I first stepped foot on the Van Hook family land. And what happened during that photo shoot, which was a morning sunrise, was transformative and something that we were in collaboration with things beyond us. It was the gritty nature of the sound of the diesel engine on the tractor, along with this, again, fragile material. The dew of the grass was wet. And when the tissue paper gets wet, it bleeds. It's called bleeding tissue paper for that reason. All of that, standing on the ground of this super rooted, grounded family of Hillsboro and the surrounding areas, it was just, it felt right. And that's how I knew I was in the right space.
I think this is something that only an artist can properly express, is these great paradoxes that you've just, you know, put your finger on. A place like North Carolina, which does have a paradoxical and a conflicting history, is home to so many people for so many reasons. You talk about the land, a connection to the land, and particularly in African-American families, to hold on. And yet the opportunities often meant leaving the land. I mean, it's very likely that your grandmother was in Boston, you know, as part of that diaspora to find greater opportunities. And now we find that being rooted in land that you can own is where the power is. I mean, all of those complex and paradoxes, cross currents that run together, are pretty hard to explain through anything but art, I would think.
Definitely. And my grandmother was part of the great black migration up north. That's where she planted roots. But she was from Texarkana, Texas, born in 1928. So she had that southern root and that southern mentality and the idea to come home. And she reminded me that we made a handmade life and you can too. She wasn't able to be an artist, but I believe if she had the same opportunities as me, she would be. But she never let me forget that in order to keep our wealth and to support black businesses and black people, you have to make a concerted effort to do so because it's not always the easier route.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that she knew somebody in the family would be an artist. That's why the basement was the way it was.
I think so. She definitely knew that.
Talk about you mentioned it a little bit, but the solo exhibit this summer at CAM Raleigh, you're going to explore this idea of the connection land. Tell us more about that.
So the exhibition is called Greater Than or Equal To, and we're using that symbol from algebra and math, you know, the Pac-Man face to the left with the line under it. When I think about constructs, including English, language, symbols, how we explain things, they're all made up. They help us describe things and explain things and attribute value. So we've talked about that a little bit. Greater than or equal to sign is a sign that shows you which number is higher or which one is better. And so a lot of times with my art, I feel like I'm caught in between this. Well, is it equal to that? Well, will it last as long as this? Well, is it as special as that? And my grandmother taught me that I choose my worth. So if I tell you, yes, we're putting it on this wall and it costs this much, I'm also entering an exchange with you and almost making my own currency through my hands. And that is an African-American tradition. We make it, it gets transformed, turned around, and then you see, you know, fried bacon bits at, you know, the top the top fancy restaurant for $28. You know, the way that we do grit cakes or black eyed peas or whatever. Black people are genius, ingenuity, amazing makers. And so I feel that way almost the same exact way as transforming or remixing or improvising or scatting through my learned education and turning it into something new.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the great, you know, I've been thinking about symbols lately and the very different kinds of symbols that we navigate every day. You have very concrete symbols. They're abstract, but a red light, right? I mean, a red light means stop. It is not ambiguous, but it's a symbol. It doesn't physically stop you. And then there's a rose, right, that has so many layers of meaning and are so subjective. And that's another kind of symbol that is beautiful precisely because it's ambiguous. And I think the artist, and as you say, the greater than or equal sign is something that, you know, depending on which side of the sign you're on, becomes very different valences, different values, and whole different expressions.
Yeah, I think that the other idea or subtext of the exhibition is judgment or suspending judgment. So if you ask a child to come in and before they enter, you say, well, please suspend all judgment, a child isn't really going to understand what you're talking about. They just see things and understand things. But judgment is passed on from your parents and the people who you look up to. So you have to check yourself when you come in and say, well, I don't get that, or that's not real art, or I don't like it, or, you know, it's subjective. But judging is something that I've been working on lately, getting away from it and allowing to exist. So the idea of meditation and mindfulness clears your mind from judgment so that what the pure thoughts can come through, that I'm not going to come in here and know what I'm talking about or put up walls or barriers before I can even introduce myself to the art and understand the art.
We talked about your father, who is an architect. There again, this is an artistic rendition, but one that needs not to be ambiguous. Hopefully the builders can, you know, get exactly what you meant. Did you talk to him about art? Did you two kind of swap notes?
Oh, we definitely did. He actually heard about the art box. I was chosen for that before he passed away, and I told him I would dedicate it to him. And so that work is called Shifting Seasons. And it's about that, again, the fragility of life, the beauty of now, how things change, how we either embrace them or we ride the wave or we get off the ship and drown. So he was excited to see that and to know about it. He always encouraged me. He was a funny guy. He just believed that I would never be an architect because I don't draw straight lines. He sent me to NC State Design Camp, and I was like, okay, I'm for sure not taking over the business.
50 cents, he could have given you a ruler. You'd have been done.
You know, I still can't do it. And when you see my art, there's always that edge, that kind of, I think I got that from my mom, the funky kind of change it up, the remix, that side I got from her. The technical side and the list-making side, that's all internal. But my outside of the lines and outside of the box thinking is more my mom. So we have these, we're a mixture of both. And I think when you think about art as being permanent or how long it's going to stay there, or when we're at war, when we're not kind to each other, when we don't like each other, when we're not respecting the planet, we're on a living, breathing ecosystem here. And it's a temporary place, but we could accelerate the damage to everything, including things that are in safes and things that have archival tint on them and things that are protected in museums with guards. If we destroy the planet, when I say we, I mean human beings, my art's gonna go, your art's gonna go, the museums will go, and everything else will go. So I'm focused on that human connection, that connection that supersedes any kind of judgment or value system. That's what my art is about. And the other day, my son asked me when the sun was going to explode, because he heard, you know, in his third grade class, it will eventually explode. So, of course, he goes to ask Alexa, and Alexa tells us, in 5 to 7 billion years, the sun will explode. But don't worry, in 500,000 years, the sun will get hot enough to boil all the water on Earth and everyone will be dead anyway. This is like a breakfast conversation. And so I was like, see, you don't have to worry, Ion. And he goes, yeah, but do I still have to do my homework?
That's the deal. He was looking to get out of his homework, and that came as bad news to him.
Not in 7 billion years. You don't have to do your homework, honey. But that type of... You just have to, don't take yourself too seriously.
But it's interesting to think about your work. And when you listen to you talk, when you hear what you're saying and you listen and take on board what it is you're saying about fragility and the lessons that you've learned and how that opens you to the possibility of things, that's one thing. But you can see the same signals, feel deeply the fragility of life and have the opposite reaction. Your reaction is to grasp, it's to get control of, it's to make more categories, it's to find safety in a category that is currently privileged, right? And to say, I won't give up that privilege because things are so fragile.
That's right, but that's all an illusion. It's not real. We wake up every day and you don't know what's going to happen. That's why you need to be kind to each other. That's why you need to say, I love you before you go to sleep. That's why you need to forgive people. That's why you need to accept people for who they are. That's why honesty is really the best policy. If you're keeping secrets, they will always come back.
Especially if you have kids.
Especially, I mean.
Talk about that. Talk about being a working mom and that life. And
so being a working mom and being an artist, thanks to Beverly McKeever, I do it on my own. I make my own money. I produce wealth through my creative two hands. So that's how I feed my family. But it didn't have to be that way, you know? And we lack confidence, I think, sometimes to know that you can be a working artist and mother. Part of that comes from having a supportive partner, and part of it comes from having supportive childcare and people who you trust to watch your kids, to know that, guess what? Both my parents were working artists. Both of them traveled the world doing what they love, and I never felt a lack of love. They came back and told us about it, or they took us with them. And
your parents, let's talk about this, because there is a certain amount of privilege in your family and even what they had. They had some wealth to begin with, and you began with a base of wealth, some wealth to begin with. So talk about that and how that plays the idea, because I know you're aware of it. There is a certain privilege that you had that maybe not others would have had, artists starting out. And how do you think about that moving forward as an artist?
First of all, Frank, I paid for graduate school myself.
Okay.
So I just want to go on record. That Phil and Nina Freelon did not, and I finished paying my grad school loan, I think, last year, and I'm proud of that. They were like, if you want to be an artist, sure, go for it. And I did assume that they would help me with that, but that was one of their lessons where it's like, okay, we got you through college, now the next step's on you. And that put into perspective the idea that if this is really what I want to do, which I think was the lesson there, then you need to put your money where it is. So I got a Stafford loan and a government loan to get me through that. And then I realized I cannot stand teaching. So then I'm like, why do I need an MFA? Anyway, I do like teaching, but just in workshop format, less semester driven. Right. Anyway, I think that that's important to know your own worth. And if you didn't have a grandmother that told you you can do it, I'm here to tell you you can do it. Beverly McKeever's here to tell you you can do it. Emma Amos, Faith Ringgold, there are women who thrived in the art world as working artists who are examples, but you kind of have to pull your own research to find these people, but they exist. There should be nothing stopping you. Again, with the world ending in 5 to 7 billion years when the sun explodes, if you're not doing what you're meant to do, everybody has access to their God-given talent. So get out of the toxic relationship. Go ahead and pursue the dream that you always wished. There's no better time than now. What are you waiting for? That's how I feel.
That sounds great. What a pleasure. By the way, we will be providing live coverage up on public radio of the end of the world five billion years from now. So we'll be there. So please consult your local listings and stay tuned to this public radio station for the end of the world. But in the meantime, let me thank you so much, Maya. What a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Maya Freelon, Durham-based artist whose work is currently on display at the Art Box at North Hills in Raleigh. An exhibit at Cam Raleigh is coming this summer in July. And we've got all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. She and her partner, Jess, have several other talks and book signings coming up. Stateofthings.org is the place to go to find out more. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holla-Mormon, and Katie Barron. Jenny Lawson is the technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.